I was thinking about, okay, what brings me joy? And I had just put on these nice alpaca socks made in the USA, and they just felt like love on my feet.
Aww.
And it felt so good and felt like such a hug and comfort that I was like, I want to make things that feel like love and that feel like a comfort, and to share that with the world.
You're listening to the Good Dirt Podcast. This is a place where we dig into the nitty-gritty of sustainable living through food, fashion, and lifestyle.
And we're your hosts, Mary and Emma Kingsley, the mother and daughter founder team of Lady Farmer. We're sowing seeds of slow living through our community platform, events, and online marketplace.
We started this podcast as a means to share the wealth of information and quality conversations that we're having in our world as we dream up and deliver ways for each of us to live into the new paradigm, one that is regenerative, balanced, and whole.
We want to put the microphone in front of the voices that need to be heard the most right now. The farmers, the dreamers, the designers, and the doers.
So come cultivate a better world with us. We're so glad you're here. Now, let's dig in.
So, I have a vivid memory of the first time that I learned what yoga was. I was in your bedroom in our house in Atlanta, and I think I was either looking at like a packet you'd brought home from a training, or you were talking to me, but I just remember like where I was and it kind of clicking in my brain and being like, what even is this? But you were like, yoga, it feels really good. And I was just so confused about how doing poses could make you feel good. I just didn't get it. And I didn't understand what you meant by mind-body connection. I don't know how old I was.
Yeah, 8 or 9.
Okay. It just was like really not a thing that people knew about or heard about. It was very kind of weird and woo-woo that you were doing yoga training.
Yeah.
No one else really did yoga. And I just thought of that the other day because I thought it was so funny. I do some tutoring, and these two kids that I work with, they're 4 and 5, and they talk about doing yoga all the time, but I guess it's so part of their world.
In the 90s, I remember having a vague, just sort of a vague sense that there was this thing called yoga.
And you were like, what, in your 30s?
Yeah. So I was interested in it. I wanted to find out about it. I sort of didn't know where to go. So I went to the Yellow Pages.
Oh my gosh.
And looked up yoga. And there was a phone number, and I called it, and a lady answered the phone.
Hilarious that you figured out what yoga was in the phone book.
Well, the white pages are where everybody's name and phone number and address were listed.
And yellow is business.
Yellow is business. Yeah. So you went, you know, you looked it up, and why? Yoga, Y-O-G-A. And, you know, I called the number. A woman answered the phone. I said, I'm interested in learning yoga. Like, what even is it? And we talked a little bit, and I ended up starting.
What even is it?
Yeah. I really didn't know. I just had a vague idea about it. So I ended up going to her class, and I started the journey with her. Her name was Jenny, and, you know, went from there, and, you know, a few years later ended up getting the training.
Yeah.
Ended up teaching yoga in our basement at our home in Georgia.
Yeah, at my school. You came to school and taught it at PE.
I did. I taught it in PE. I taught to the teachers after school, and
you've always been an entrepreneur.
Well,
yoga.
Yeah.
I just thought that was so funny because I just did want to say too, I love how much you are a trendsetter mom.
Oh,
always doing things before other people.
Thank you.
I mean, obviously yoga is like one of the oldest traditions ever. So you obviously didn't do it before everyone else. But I will say, in our community in suburban Atlanta in the 90s, no one knew what you were talking about.
Yeah, that whole movement quickly arrived.
Yeah.
Before too long. You know, everybody was doing it.
Which is a whole other, I mean, gosh, I'm sure there are podcasts about that. Just the westernized yoga phenomenon. It's amazing.
Well, your brother knows all about that. He studied that.
Mm. Yeah. So the reason that we're talking about that today is because we have a lovely, beautiful, amazing yoga teacher. Our guest today is Amanda Agricola. She's many things. Yoga is one of the ways that she expresses her teaching and her community building. And she also creates bespoke slow fashion pieces, and her brand is Flowy Life. She kind of talks about it more in the interview, but I just love how she's married this idea of slow and sustainable fashion with yoga and in kind of this beautiful synchronistic art way. And yeah, we obviously love that here at Lady Farmer. And I just wonder, Mom, if you have any thoughts to add about that, about how yoga and slow fashion are related.
Well, I will think of a real kind of ironic thing. And we do talk about this in the episode, but how yoga soon swept the nation, and not only in the exercise and the world of trends in keeping fit and so forth, but in the fashion world,
mm-hmm.
with the advent of yoga pants. And then, so stay tuned to the discussion where we talk about how yoga pants have become a huge problem in the fast fashion world. So
yeah, so yoga pants are not slow fashion. But yoga as a concept, yes. I believe, is beautifully married to slow fashion.
A little bit of irony there. So here we have Amanda, who is the very picture of slow, intentional making, creating, being in the world of yoga and slow fashion and intentional living.
Yeah.
Amanda's mission is to cultivate a deeper appreciation for the materials that cover our bodies. And her approach is one that is regenerative and interactive, inviting participation in the making process through natural dye workshops and distributing seeds for others to start growing their own dye gardens.
We loved our chat, and we hope that you do too.
And here's Amanda.
I'm Amanda Agricola. I'm the founder of Flowy, which is a sustainable clothing and lifestyle project that I started about 3 years ago, going on 4 years now, actually. And my background really is in art. As we were just saying, I've dabbled in a lot of things, which makes me a Renaissance woman.
Yes. To you listeners, we just coined that phrase before we got started.
I don't know if we coined it.
Well,
it exists.
We're bringing it back, or whatever you want to say about
that. We changed it from Renaissance man to Renaissance woman.
Yes.
Yeah. It doesn't get used that way.
Right.
So I am making sustainable garments. Mostly they're staple garments, things that you would wear every week, probably. T-shirts, tunics, comfortable undergarments, things that don't really get in your way, and don't inhibit your flow, hence the name. And they're all made with hemp and organic cotton, which are two fibers that are all natural, which means that they biodegrade. And that was one of the big catalysts for starting the project, was really that I was practicing yoga and not finding a lot of, I guess this is really how I started sewing again. My return to sewing, because I learned how to sew from my grandmother and my mother when I was young, but I didn't employ that skill very often, except for in sometimes in art projects. I wasn't making my own clothes until I was in a yoga program, a teacher training program. And I was also practicing Kundalini yoga, which required natural fiber clothing. And it was hard for me to find yoga clothes that were all natural fibers. It was something about, magnifying your energetic aura for that practice, which is all about energetics and stuff. So I couldn't really find plain white natural fiber yoga clothes. So I started to dabble in making my own. And so I realized that there was just sort of a gap in the market there. And a lot of things, I found a lot of polyester heavily dyed and beautiful, crazy prints and patterns, but none of it really as conscious of the materials as I would have liked. And so that was all while I was kind of starting to do that while I was still in grad school, and I was still working on art project after art project. And then I graduated from MICA and I got my first solo show, and I was working on a show that looked at different locations with mining histories and histories of extraction from the earth and sort of extractive economies. And as I would travel between Maryland and my home state where I was born, of Alabama, I would sometimes stop at different places where there were some mining histories, like Dahlonega, Georgia. And there were some places in Alabama that had mining histories, or still do have mining histories of different resources, ore and marble and such, and collect soils all along the way. And so then what I was doing is making an earth pigment quilt. So I was learning all about earth pigments and dyeing with earth pigments. And I was getting really excited about their potential for art making and using materials that were less harmful to the earth, and printing with things that were not synthetic and stuff like that. So that led me to want to explore more of the natural dye world, the world of natural dyes. So I started learning about indigo first and then got really into indigo and love indigo and did a whole nother art project where I made this like tent out of something, some old sheets that I had cut up and turned into this sort of like leafy tent structure and dyed with indigo and recycled materials and stuff. So I was simultaneously put in both worlds of like making art and using these natural materials that I was coming to love. And it was also giving me this outlet that I had been so desperately looking for to like connect back with nature and with the earth. And I think it really started to like make me feel better. Like I was so immersed in like technology and like working on my computer before and doing a lot of digital work. And then I started to do this more intuitive process, hands-on and hands in the dirt, getting my hands on plants and figuring out what colors they make and exploring the world through a new lens of color, of natural dyes. And so all the while, I was still sometimes making clothes for myself. And then I was like, why don't I just like shift a little bit from talking about these extractive economies and these problematic things that are going on in the earth to actually like participating in this global movement of slow fashion, which is actually participating in the conversation and trying to change our habits and be mindful of what we're investing in and things that we're putting on our bodies and stuff like that. So then I started to really think about what I could do with those clothes that I was making. And I was really enjoying doing the undergarments because they were small and manageable. And like with natural dyes, you know, it's like such a process and it requires several steps. So with something smaller, I was able to like really manage that, like using that process more easily. So that's how I got to, that was like the roundabout way that brought me to making naturally dyed, infused with intentions, undergarments that were healthy for the wearer, more healthy than what I could find out there at the time. Now I feel like there's so many more sustainable underwear options on the market. But at the time I was surprised to see that there was, you know, one, maybe two out there and they were in different countries. So I thought, well, I'll make some that I don't have to order from Australia or wherever.
I want to go back and ask just a couple of questions. You said you were in grad school at MICA. Can you tell us?
At Maryland Institute College of Art. No, that's an acronym that we throw around in Baltimore because it's so ubiquitous here.
Right.
I forget that it's not everywhere.
It was interesting that you went to MICA and you were studying mining. So I thought that was interesting. Yeah. But anyway, little side note there. So the other thing was in graduate school, what was your primary art form before you started moving towards the natural dyes and the minerals and all that?
Yeah, I was really there trying to expand my skills in coding and learning about digital fabrication and filling in some of the gaps that I felt like I needed to fill in from my undergraduate, which was very traditional art-based focus on color theory and painting and sculpture. And it was all very formal. And then I wanted some more, like I wanted to kind of broaden my technical skill set. So I was doing several different projects that would involve some form of connection with the audience where it would trigger some feedback that would do something else, like play a video when somebody sat on a certain sculpture or something like that.
Okay.
You know,
so okay.
All these kinds of feedback and the connectivity was something that's always been really important in my art. And so that's why I still feel comfortable calling Flowy a project because it's all about this like connection with others and with yourself, you know, and with the earth, connection between the person that's wearing the garment and those materials that made them up and connecting sort of through like learning and educational models too. I try to, you know, infuse some like different elements of learning throughout too, like on my blog and offering workshops hands-on.
Okay, so you ended up pivoting like 180 from the technological and the digital all the way to like the earth and the earth minerals. And yeah, that's really wonderful. And
something I think about a lot too is how extractive technology is. Like,
yeah,
it's amazing. I mean, look, here we are. What would we be doing without it? How would we have a podcast?
Talk about mining.
Yeah, it is really fascinating.
Yes. Okay, and the other thing that jumped out at me was, if I understood this correctly, you were in a Kundalini yoga class and they required you to wear clothing that was all natural materials.
Yeah, it was more of like a heavy, like a strong suggestion that this will like sort of empower your practice more.
Okay.
All of which I've come to be like, I don't know. I'm not really sure that that has, like, if that's true or not, but it certainly feels better when you know that something is gonna not be in a landfill later and cause like adding to the problems that we see.
Yeah.
So there's an energy to that, knowing.
I think. Generally just wearing natural fibers like feels better. So I imagine in an intense physical activity where like we don't really wear natural fibers doing exercise anymore because, you know, you get sweaty and it's yucky, whatever. And so when we're so used to these different types of fibers, so I imagine having that experience, kind of see what you're saying, like, does it have an effect? No, but it definitely like feels good, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really interested in this little piece because, you know, I've never heard that connection made from that standpoint, but I've always thought that, you know, when you're wearing clothes with the synthetics, then those are man-made things. Those are chemicals that are created in a lab, you know, to make fabrics behave a certain way, but they're not natural, of course. They're not of nature. They're on our skin. And yeah, if you want to think about energetics or go in that direction, of course, those materials are going to transmit different waves onto into and through your body. I mean, I don't know much about that science, but
no, it's hard to know. Yeah. It's like hard to know what that vibrational quality
absolutely
is for that particular material.
And I think it's so interesting that this yoga class was recommending that for y'all because it's probably the yoga industry in the Western world that really promoted.
Well, continues to promote. I'm not sure it's in the past tense.
Had a huge part in bringing the exercise wear into the mainstream. I mean, yoga pants are the first thing we think of when we think of microfibers these days, or I do. What is the garment that we most associate with the huge problem of microplastics? Well, it's yoga pants. That's where it was first kind of discovered.
Yeah, and fleece jackets too.
Exactly. And since people for a good while there, and probably still, I don't know, I'm a little out of touch with fashion trends per se, but, you know, yoga pants were not just for exercise anymore. It was everything.
Yeah, I think that's great to point that out, that it's there's a lot to the materials that we don't know. And then fast forward a few years, that's when I started to learn more about the sort of endocrine disruption of plastics into your hormones and stuff, too.
Absolutely.
So, there's an actual health concern.
For sure, for sure. And I feel like we talk about that so much, I forget to even say it when it's appropriate. But yeah, synthetics against your skin has been shown to be disrupting to your endocrine system, which is what? Everything. Right. Moods, sleep, you know, digestion. Right. It's just simply everything. And yeah, that sounds broad, endocrine disrupting, but that's the sort of quick way to kind of sum up all these sort of subtle effects that these things can have on us and have been shown to have on us.
Mm-hmm. And
the dyes,
the synthetic dyes, unfortunately have like a lot of petroleum that goes into the manufacturing of them.
Yes.
You know, that has an environmental impact, but then it's also another layer of those endocrine disruptors comes from the dyes and stuff.
Yeah. Too. So this all like boils down to the question of if we seek out all natural fibers, meaning fibers that occur in nature, I think plants or animals that occur without human synthetic inputs and blends. And personally, I've been trying to move in that direction over the last few years, especially since we've been doing this work. And it's quite a challenge to find things that aren't blended with synthetics. And there are some old favorite garments of mine that, you know, I wore and wore and never thought about it and then started looking into these things. Check the garment. Uh-oh, it's 60% polyester. I never realized that. So then the question is, well, I have it in my closet. If I get rid of it, it goes potentially into the landfill and sits there for thousands of years. or I can just keep wearing it because I have it. But then there goes the experiment of what is it like wearing only natural materials. So I'm sort of betwixt in between there. But I do find that the things that are 100% natural are very satisfying to wear. It feels good. How much of that is psychological? I don't know. But
yeah,
given what we just said about these things being shown to have chemical effects in your body, I think there's something to it.
I think so too. I think there's something to the disruption of the chemicals in the clothing. And you can smell it sometimes in certain fibers. It's like, oh, wow, these are like very chemically smelly.
Yeah.
I ordered, full disclosure, I'm not perfect.
Oh, really?
I wear things that are, you know, have polyester in them. Like, especially, I ordered a pair of leggings from Amazon that were maternity leggings, just because I was like, I don't want to spend an arm and a leg getting leggings that I'm going to wear for 2 months. When they come, they smell, you can smell them. You open up the package and you're like, oh God, there's a reason that I favor natural fibers and natural dyes and stuff, because you can tell when it's that there's stuff in there that you wouldn't put in your body. So why would we put it on our body? Because, you know, our skin is our largest organ. It is absorbing. While we're not as absorbent as like a frog or an amphibian, we're still pulling in parts of our environment through our skin all the time. So I always think that it's just better to have those natural things as natural as you can find, or even dyes. They have dyes that are synthetic but are more environmentally friendly.
Yeah, there's a range.
And health friendly.
Yeah, and just FYI, we're not perfect either. We do not claim to be perfect, because it's a very imperfect system, and it's just really hard to be absolute in that.
It's really hard. Think about it, like socks. Like, if they didn't have a little bit of stretch in them or cling, then we would need to wear what, garters? Is that why people had garters?
Yes.
To hold up your socks. Like what? It's just crazy.
Totally. Right. So speaking of socks, this is another thing that I like to talk about or point out. We have socks in the Lady Farmer Marketplace that are almost 100% organic cotton. The only synthetic is up at the top, to Emma's point, to keep them from sagging too much. They're still kind of slouchy, but the only nylon is up at the very, very top. So your foot is housed in organic cotton. So this is great, and this is what we want.
Oh,
so this is the socks we carry. These are the socks that I dye, and, you know, I'll come out with the seasonal colors and all that kind of stuff. But since they're not laced with plastic, and they're great socks, and I wear them all the time, guess what? They get holes in them. And it's such a catch-22, because people, you know, they're going to pay a little more because these are organic cotton socks, hand-dyed, whatever. And then they wear them for a year, year and a half or whatever, and then they start getting holes, and they say, oh, well, these don't last very long. Why would I spend more money if they're not going to last as long as the ones I get a six-pack on Amazon?
Well, that's a darning project.
Exactly. So the point is that, you know, you have to make those choices. And yes, those socks that you love and feel wonderful on your foot, because they are natural. And, you know, your feet absorb all kinds of energy. Your feet are important receptors. So when you think about it, do you want your foot wrapped in something laced with plastic? I don't. But it's really hard to find socks that aren't. So my point being, have these natural fibers. They're going to wear out because they are natural. So it's different mindset. You have to be looking for it. You have to be like super intentional about why you want a certain product. And yeah, and be willing to fix it. When we send out our socks, we explain this. We have a little insert and we explain it. And we offer people, if they want, if they get holes in their socks, they can send them back to us for a repair.
See, that is amazing. I think that first of all, I'm going to circle back to socks as being important to also why I am in the realm of making clothes too, because I love what we're talking about socks, because socks are just like my favorite article.
They are great.
But I think that option to mend or option to update or to not throw away is something that's the future of making things last. And sort of repairing the damage that's been done by fast fashion and favoring a model that allows for more send backs and redo this or mend it. This year, for the first time, I have a barber jacket that I've had for 10 years. And this was the first year that I sent it back to have all the repairs done. And it came back and it was like a brand new jacket. It was like, that is so cool. And
that
so
is
exciting
so cool.
That, like, I can have this jacket for life and give it to you know, my offspring, and they can have it and keep mending it. And I try to offer that as well for dyeing, like not so much with the undergarments, but for shirts and things that if somebody gets a stain or if it gets dingy, send it back and I'll indigo dye it. And like, so I love doing things like that, like exchanges where you're like encouraging. It's not some kind of like money-making scheme. It's not like you're not getting rich by improving somebody's clothes that they already bought from you. It's in fact, it would be better if you just had them buy something new for your own self. But for the earth, it's like a choice that we have to make, you know, it's like, if we want to see change happen, we have to, like, not to be cheesy or cliche, but we have to be that change. And so I think that doing that, offering services like that is so important.
Yes. And a person might think that's the added value to them. That's the thing that might make them decide to buy these instead of going to Amazon and buying the much cheaper ones that are going to arrive the next day and all that kind of stuff. So, well, if, you know, if they're willing to actually take it back, repair it, and send it back to me, then that's a value. The person making this or the company making it values it to the point where maybe I can value too. It's sort of like, I guess, modeling value or modeling priorities or, and again, not that we're perfect or anything. They're just these principles that we want to communicate and help. There's actually a lot of unlearning. You hear a lot of times you can spend more on sustainable fashion because it's going to last longer. That's true to a certain extent, but in some instances, like the socks, that's not the point. That's not why you make that decision, in our view.
It's a big sacrifice, though. It's a big mindset shift.
It totally is.
What kind of crazy person would intentionally choose socks that cost more and you will get holes in them?
Yeah, right. That's the big question.
Hemp is such a strong fiber, and I know that we're not able to source it in the U.S. because it's not grown here or manufactured here, but I've done some digging with the manufacturer that I sourced from in California that makes the blends of organic cotton and hemp. And as far as I can tell from emailing back and forth and asking questions is that they try to be as ethical and sustainable throughout the process of manufacturing. It's hard for me to know really without like going to visit the facilities there. So I feel like transparency is still not awesome. Like it's not great at every level of manufacturing clothing, but I will say that the shirts and the underwear that I've made from the hemp blended in with the organic cotton don't get those tiny holes. The organic cotton t-shirts that I bought at the same time that I made one of the hemp garments with has the little bitty holes that you get in the t-shirt eventually once you've washed it enough times, which is fine. I don't mind holes, honestly. Like I think the holier and softer something gets, the more luxurious and delicious it is. But I have noticed that it's true what they say about the hemp fiber being so strong, and that it's like none of the things that I've had made for 4 years now have those tiny little cotton holes that you typically get in cotton jersey fabric. So that is just something that I noted the other day and I was like, this is true. And I've like tested it.
So that brings me to the question of, do you order, you obviously order some things already made to dye and so forth. And are some of the things you're actually making yourself out of fabrics, or what's your process? And is this just you?
Yeah, it is. Most of it is just me. So the only thing I order that's pre-made are socks.
Oh.
And then everything else is, I order the woven cloth from a vendor out of California. That's the farthest away that I source from. Everything else that I source from, like my labels, boxes, and packing materials are all sourced as close to Baltimore as possible so that I have the least amount of carbon footprint there. And then everything else I do myself. I sew the garments. Oh, the elastic bands.
Ah.
Those are the things that I've unaccounted for where those come from. I'd like to move towards eliminating most of the elastic, but like at the bottom of the bralettes and things like that, it's really hard to avoid using elastic and still have, you know, a supportive enough bra that you're feeling good about moving around and not falling out of.
I am super impressed that you're actually sewing these undergarments, that you're making them with your own hands. That's amazing, Amanda. These are handmade things and hand dyed. My goodness, everybody out there, yeah. These are super, super unique and special garments. So pay attention.
They're truly stuff. They're very, very slow fashion.
At what point did yoga come in, and how does your yoga sort of work with your slow fashion?
So let me back up for 1 second and say that I also just made a kit where you can order an undergarment, a bra, and then you can dye it yourself.
Oh, cool.
And that was one of my goals from the beginning, was to like introduce people to the process, so that like if you're a part of the process of a garment, I think that you're like much less likely to get rid of it very quickly. Yeah. Like if you're going to hold on to it because you've put your labor into it. And so it breaks down exactly how to dye the garment, which is just one step of the process. You know, it's been fibers have been woven and all of that. And then I've sewn it, and, you know, now you're dyeing it, but that could still be a 24-hour process if you do it the slow way. You know, so I think that it's exciting to show people that they can be a part of the process, A, and then they can take some seeds, plant them in their garden, re-dye it when the time comes that they want to re-dye it, because natural dyes do tend to fade quicker than synthetic dyes. And it's like, you know, now you know kind of what the slow fashion process is like. It's truly slow. It's truly a labor of love.
And to your point, it doesn't really fit into the capitalist model of the bottom line and, you know, making big profits and all that. It just doesn't work. You can't scale up what you're doing to make a living.
No, that's one of the hardest things about sustainable like garments, is that you can't scale and be sustainable. No. It's hard to be truly sustainable and to scale your business.
Yeah.
You can only scale to a certain point, and then, you know, you have to know like at what point does it stop becoming sustainable, which is why I tried to think about what is the life cycle of the garment, and how could you make that part of the sustainability model?
Yeah. And something that we've kind of been talking a lot in our house is like, maybe if it's like in the capitalist model at all, then it's just, not to go on a whole rant, but just the idea of extracting, like we're talking about, exchanging money, an item or something from, like, there's a major imbalance there. And I think that's sort of what we're dealing with in this, you know, trying to shift the paradigm, trying to think about things differently. And there's no really clear, perfect answer. You know, you can't check all the boxes, all this stuff. And I think it's because we're really seeing a breakdown of the system, and we're really just like starting to understand that the system is what's not conducive. We don't know how to change the system, but if you're still doing things within the system, they're going to be not perfect. And obviously, perfection isn't the goal, but
the point is, like, is it right now we have no alternative to the system.
Yeah, so we're trying to do things within the system, therefore they are inherently going to be flawed.
And so we sort of bounce around within it. Yeah. Doing the best we can, making the small changes. And have you ever read the book Ishmael by Daniel Quinn?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So he talks about all this. He talks about, I recently read it. I read it over the holidays, and it's so way out there that to even start it would like be a whole nother podcast. But it's fiction, but it's very much about all of this from the get-go. There's like before you read Ishmael and after you read Ishmael.
And right now, Mary is.
I'm after you.
Now I have to read it.
Well, when you do, let me know, because I want to talk to, you know, I'm going around to everybody. You have to read Ishmael. And they're like, yeah.
Why don't you make it the next book?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Almanac plug.
You know, it might be outvoted. There's sort of a committee on this. And then that book just opened up this whole thing of other related books. I mean, I've been on this thing. Like this whole paradigm shifting trip where I hardly even know what to do.
Right.
And very, very much craving interaction about it. So if you do read it, let me know. And yeah, it is coming up the almanac at some point. It might be a couple of seasons off, but people listening out there, so we have the book club in the almanac. So that's what Amanda is referring to, because Amanda is a member in our almanac and does take part in the book club. So anyway,
it's amazing. It's great to have a place to connect with so many people about these ideas and having these discussions more regularly than you would otherwise.
Yes.
But yeah, I have a book, I don't know if it's anything like Ishmael, but I read it in the past year. Tomorrow Will Be Better. I'm blanking on her name, but she wrote A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Uh-huh. And this is like a lesser known book. And it kind of painted a picture of what life was like in, you know, the 1920s, and how much more people would consider the life cycle of something. Like she would buy a dress and think about, I can dye it pink and then I can dye it brown and then I can dye it black. Wow. You know, like that was part of her budgeting for her life. Things were so much more difficult. I mean, this is all relative. I always think that looking back, it seems like things were so much more difficult. Maybe in a lot of ways, things are more challenging today in some ways. But either way, I feel like there was like a tighter expendable income in your average family, like overall. And so people would consider these choices that they were making much more carefully and slowly and think about the longevity of something versus some kind of like immediate satisfaction, which we're much more feel inclined to think about trends and immediate gratification, instant gratification now than ever before.
There has been such a huge shift in the way we incorporate textiles into our lives. And we were talking about this on a podcast yesterday, actually. We had interviewed a historian from Mount Vernon that told us that 40% of the budget at Mount Vernon, George Washington's budget for running the estate, 40% was just on textiles for clothes and things.
Wow.
Yeah, it was the most expensive thing. It was over food. It was over like, you know, management of the house and it was over everything. It was the most expensive line item. So clothes were very, very valued. And now the statistic is very, very low. I mean, I think it's like, what is it? Less than 5% of your
7% or
something, something really low.
Less, definitely less than 10.
It's a fraction of what it was 200 years ago. And that speaks to the fact that we just treat it as disposable, basically, which is absolutely true. I mean, the average person throws away like 80 pounds of textiles into the landfill every year, every American. And that's pretty staggering when you think about the fact that just 200 years ago, it was textiles, not even clothing, but the textiles to make the clothing were 40% of your expenditures in your house and in your home. And then you had to make them.
That is amazing, right? You'd pick the cloth and have them made. Well, I wonder, has the government ever thought of offering subsidies to fashion industry? Because what I have started thinking is that, I mean, we kind of attack fast fashion, but what the real issue is that the labor and how do you offset? Like, instead of fast fashion shutting down, which is bad for all of those employees, then what do you do to actually, A, make more transparency, and B, try to like lift them up more instead of just shutting down completely, instead of saying, okay, well, we're moving back to the U.S. because that's what's on trend now and screw everybody else.
Yeah, again, it goes back to the like,
there's got to be other ways.
Yeah, like who are we helping if we just shut it all down, right? We're actually disrupting a lot. But at the same time, it kind of goes back to, and again, there's no like blame here, not blaming anyone. But it sort of goes back to, why are we producing so much? Well, we're buying so much. Well, why are we buying so much? That's a big question. But it's like, there's kind of, the market was created and generated, and like problems are generated to make us buy things to solve them. Yeah, clothing was made cheaper on a big scale so that people could afford it and buy more of it, and lining the pockets of people who created that system. So not even blaming them, because what are you going to do? You know, you're going to figure out ways to make money in the world. So I think it's kind of like a reevaluation of, yes, things need to be accessible, but also, what are we making accessible? Is that the most necessary thing to make accessible? What if we focused on high quality food and education and those sort of things, and re-educating on, again, talking about the olden times. In the olden times, people had two outfits, three, you know, high quality things. Like, yes, everyone needs access to high quality clothing, but we don't need that much of it, really. The issue is the issue itself.
Yeah. So it's a vicious cycle where the NAFTA laws came and domestic manufacturing went overseas, made it possible to generate all this stuff.
Even when things were here in America, it was not good. Children, laborers, factory fires. Basically, as soon as things got on mass scale.
Yeah. Industrial revolution, basically. Yeah. But anyway, then it creates, you know, if you create the, you know, build it and they will come, I guess. You create the product and then it creates demand for that product, and it's a vicious cycle. But back to what you said a few minutes ago, Amanda, about asking about could the government subsidize it and get workers better paid so that the manufacturing maybe could come back to the country. I don't know. I'm certainly no economist and I don't really understand how it works, but I just know that that hasn't worked very well in the food industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's created
right
problems that we're really dealing with now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. If we look at that, it's not a very good model. I just wonder, it's like, how can we go from it being like 40% of the mm-hmm. household
yeah.
budget to it being like 4 or 5%? How do we slowly, like incrementally, like tick it back mm-hmm. up? It's in its importance a little bit in people's minds, I guess. I mean, it can be at like a level of just reprogramming our thinking about, I think that's kind of what we're doing.
Absolutely. Unlearning the idea that everything should be as cheap as possible.
Right.
And maybe turning that around and having people ask, why is that so cheap? I better watch out for that.
Right.
What does that mean?
Right.
That would be a revolution.
Whose expense am I getting this?
Yeah. And cheap for who?
Yeah. That should always be the number one question, I think, when shopping.
Yeah. And we've had, even in our production and manufacturing experience, we've had people ask us, you know, we said these are sustainable items and people say, it's sustainable for who? I can't afford that dress or whatever.
Yeah. And I guess in the work we're doing, we prioritize the makers and, you know, the process. And so hopefully we're making it sustainable for them, but it's a good question. It's not sustainable for the consumer.
It's a good question.
For most consumers, the way that ethical fashion is now, it's not quote unquote sustainable, because guess what? You don't need to buy clothes all the time. Like, we need good quality things in small amounts.
Yeah. And that's the relearning and learning.
Or we need to think about, what can we do if we get tired of this garment? Like, yeah. What can we do to it to alter it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And alterations are not as big of a thing anymore. Thinking about redyeing something. I mean, that's what I love about dyeing, is that you can just kind of dye and over dye and redye and
give new life.
So many opportunities to give something new life. Yeah. I definitely plan that out in what I buy. I like to get to things that are like, start out as natural and then think, okay, when it gets a little dirty or whatever, I'll dye it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the white shirts that have gotten, dip them in the indigo vat, man. And just awesome. Mm-hmm. So you were going to talk about your yoga journey and how that ties into all this. So maybe we can circle back to that.
This is a perfect segue, I think, because it's sort of in keeping with, I guess, the yoga really taught me about principles of non-harming, you know, which I thought I could employ more in the clothes that I buy. So like in the clothes that I wear and what I support. And so non-harming is like ahimsa in the yogic tradition. And that was one of the big influences, is to just try to create things that were a little less harmful to the planet and to people. And the process was very considered throughout. I would say that yoga really fuels my inner connection with my inner landscape. Like, I think of the yoga as a way of tending my inner garden, inner landscape. Mm. And then that is what comes forth. And through me, I'm able to like do more to tend the world outside of me. So it's sort of like this inside and outside balance. And one of the phrases that I've always loved from astrology and alchemy is, as above, so below, and as within, so without. So I think of that yoga and lifestyle connection is the within, and the without part is like when you're balanced and when you're feeling at peace, and you can then bring that balance and that peace into the things that you're doing, you know, in your life. And so that's been the real connection for me, maintaining those balances.
So on the same lines, how would you describe slow living and how do you embrace that in your life?
Yeah, I think just making considered choices, mm-hmm. taking the time to really think about what you're buying and just taking everything in stride, sort of, and like going more slowly. And as you do that, I think you end up buying less things that you don't need and using what you have. Or like last year, I really started mending again in this Christmas for my mom. One of her Christmas presents is that I darned one of the sweaters that she had like 5 different holes in.
Aww.
And it was just like a slow craft practice. Like, I think these slow old ways connect us back with some truths of our ancestors.
Yeah.
And I think that lives and our spirit and like, and also, you know, the earth and the choices that we make. Again, I'm not, I have a ways to go, I think, especially in regards to food, because being a business owner and doing almost everything on my own, sometimes I'll have moments where I get busy and I'll buy a microwavable meal for myself because I haven't planned well for the week. So there's like an ebb and flow, I think, always in life. And
definitely. Yeah.
And I'm still yet to make sourdough bread. I'm so intimidated by sourdough bread, but I know this year is going to be the year that I do it.
Oh, it's so fun and it's actually so easy. I definitely, you can do it.
Well, you're about to have a baby, so don't put pressure on yourself.
Yeah.
You've got such good resources on sourdough breads and stuff. So I know that I've got the resources I need and the people to talk to.
Yeah.
I'm ready to do it.
I think you will find it way less intimidating than you think.
I know. It's so funny. Yeah. Those things, I think about that a lot, like with sourdough. And then, of course, kefir, which we also love talking about on here. Kind of these fermented, like living things. It's so intimidating for some reason. But yeah. You know, you do it a couple times and you realize, actually, like we're saying, how simple it is. And it's kind of like, it's one of those things where I'm like, they've been lying to us. Like, I've bought this story for years that I have to pay more money for healthy food and I have to go to Whole Foods to get it or, you know, whatever, like grocery store. And it's actually, if you just kind of know how to use what's around you and like literally sourdough is like, it's just the little micro things in the air that's eating the flour. Just
getting them to work for you.
Literally
is all.
Flour, water, and salt. Bacteria. That makes the starter.
Right.
And then
salt.
Anyways, obviously it's a hurdle and it's scary at first, but then it kind of unlocks something. You're like, whoa, this is so simple. And it's really empowering. Yeah.
I think of that intimidation that it's been like, I don't know, like the barrier to overcome in gardening as well.
Yes, and I have that with gardening.
Simple.
Yeah.
I mean, but like once you do it, you're like, it's hard to mess this up.
Yeah.
It, with a lot of plants that you can grow yourself, it's very hard to mess it up as long as you water and stuff.
Yeah.
It's true. Like you just, you know, you decide you're going to work with nature, you're going to work with things that have worked since the beginning of time. You're just going to step into it and take part. And it's a beautiful thing. And is it 100%? Heck no. But it's just part of the ebb and flow, you know, and you just get into it and it feels really good. I guess I started making sourdough bread. Wait, I was like in my 20s. It was probably maybe when I had my first apartment or something. I don't know what it was. And I was very conscious of this feeling of working in the dough. And I'm like, what is that feeling? I couldn't even identify it. And then thought about it some more and I realized that I was doing something. I had my hands in something that humans had been doing for thousands and thousands of years. And so it connected me with the past. It connected me with all humans. And it was a really cool thing. And I've sort of carried that forward. Like, what connects us to our source and our origins and our traditions? And, you know, we live in such a new society. Most things around us are just really new. Technology and transportation and communication and all these things are so recent in the human race that I think we crave things that take us back spiritually and on a deep level, in a cellular way, I guess. We're still the same organism we were like 200,000 years ago when Homo sapiens first appeared. We're still the same biological organism, but we're having to operate in a completely crazy new environment. So anyway, that was a tangent.
That's beautiful. No, that was a beautiful tangent. So well said.
If it's not too big of a question, I'm really interested because you are about to have a baby and it's a crazy world. What are you thinking about that? Like, how are you thinking about motherhood? And do you feel like, I mean, every time to have a baby is going to be a unique time, right? But I'm wondering what you're thinking about, like, bringing life into this world that we're in right now
with all the questions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a big question. And I feel like I've been worrying about that whole, we're in a global pandemic that shows no sign of stopping.
Yeah.
So, you know, what have I done? So I have those moments. But then I also feel like it's such a hopeful thing to know that I'm bringing up the next generation, and the things that I do well and the things that I do that are good, I've learned from my ancestors, from my mom and my grandmother, and that I've added to them. I've, you know, I've tried to improve on the technology of life.
Yeah.
And improve my choices in the world. And I feel like this is like a generational long effort. And I think what we're all doing is trying to figure out how we can keep this earth as healthy for all creatures mm-hmm. going forward. And that's not going to happen in our lifetime, maybe, that we see this incredible impact. But over time, with more generations that can start to be more conscious and mm-hmm. and be taught from a young age how to be careful, considerate stewards of the world. I think that's yeah. a powerful change. So that's exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting and hopeful. And I guess it's much easier to unlearn things if you're unlearning them from out of the womb. Like if you have people yeah. bringing you into the world, teaching you already a different way. Like I feel like our struggle right now is we all seem to be collectively waking up, be like, whoa, the way we've been doing it is wrong. But if we're teaching our children
yeah.
a different way, maybe it'll be a little
from the get-go
quicker.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's your opportunity, Amanda, to like really literally birth a new consciousness.
No pressure.
Yeah. No pressure. It's in your hands.
Yes.
No, but you're part of it. However, small or incremental in the big yeah. picture is huge. So
that's cool.
Yeah. yeah.
And don't worry, you don't yeah, have to be perfect.
Thanks. That'll be my first teaching, is not to strive for perfection.
Yeah, definitely. So what does the good dirt mean to you?
Oh, my favorite question. I think of the good dirt as kind of like what we've been saying. All of this knowledge, generational, being added together is similar to compost and creating good soil, nutrient rich for things and for life to grow out of and be nourished by. And so in regards to like this podcast, I think of the good dirt as like all of the minds that you're melding together, you're bringing together, and the mm-hmm. inspirations that all kind of like combine and make this wonderful, rich, good dirt that's going to feed us and inspire us to go forward. I mean, it really, really does inspire me. I put on the good dirt whenever I'm sowing, and it always sparks new ideas of like new choices I can start to try to make. And
yeah.
Just thank new you. Ideas.
Oh, that's yeah. wonderful.
Thank you. When I read your blog about your grandmother, I thought it was named after your grandmother, Flo.
Oh, right. That was, yeah.
Was that part of it?
That was just a happy accident.
Oh, okay.
I think subconsciously it was there because yeah. She did teach me how to sew up little holes in socks. And so, and she was a seamstress herself.
Yeah, you mentioned at the beginning she was one who taught you how to sew. So that was your intro.
Yeah. Yeah. And that blog or series of blogs, I forget if it was all in a piece, but great storytelling.
Oh,
really good, really well written. Felt like I was diving into a novel. Yeah.
Oh, that's so great. Thank yeah. you so much.
It was good. So if you ever have inklings.
I love writing.
Oh, mm-hmm. You're good.
I do. I love writing stories, but I rarely share them. So I thank you for the positive feedback, because maybe it'll encourage me to share my writing more.
Oh, please do.
It did read like the beginning of some sort of really great memoir or something, or even a novel. So it was good. I liked it. I wanted more.
Her name was, I just realized we didn't say her name is Florine.
Yeah.
Florine.
Such an old-fashioned Florine, but yeah. we called her Flo.
And a character.
She's very much a character worth writing about.
Was she an Alabama grandmother?
Yes, an Alabama okay. grandmother.
Yeah.
Technically a Georgia. She grew up in Columbus, Georgia.
Okay.
But later moved to Alabama when my mom moved to Birmingham.
Yeah. So you're from Birmingham.
Uh-huh.
Interesting. Yeah. And the whole thing sort of has a Southern Gothic
yeah.
framework to it as well. So
yeah.
you might have the beginnings of something.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. All of my stories are very Southern Gothic.
Yeah. We love it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're Southern.
Oh, I'm Southern Gothic myself, so I relate to it.
It takes one to know one.
Yeah, yeah. It does.
Before we wrap up here, is there anything else that you'd like to leave with our audience or that you want people to understand about the work that you do?
Yeah, I feel like one of the things, the barriers that I had to overcome was thinking that I had to like fit into an easily definable box. And as mm-hmm. you can tell from my story, it's been very like organic, and I still don't define myself as just like this like one thing. So don't be afraid to explore, even if it's something that's like divergent from, yeah, from what it is that your schooling was in.
Yeah.
I think follow your passion. And oh yeah, I never came back to the socks.
So oh yeah.
Another thing.
Go for it.
Another thing that inspired Chloe was that I was thinking about, okay, what brings me joy? Like this, I was like Saturn return thinking about like what in life brings me the most joy. And I had just put on these like alpaca socks that were like hand, you know, nice alpaca socks made in the USA. And they just felt like love on my feet. Aww. And it just, like Mary said earlier, like your feet absorb so much energetically. And it felt so good and felt like such a hug and comfort that I was like, I want to make things that feel like love and that feel like a comfort and to share that with the world. So I think socks are so special in that way, especially well-made socks.
Oh, they are.
But I hope my underwear are as well.
That's so special to make things that feel like love and share them with the world. That's,
I think that's we just identified our teaser there.
Yeah.
This has been really fun.
This has been fun.
So much to talk about and just like sitting around having a cup of coffee with a friend.
I know.
It's been great.
It's really great to see y'all and talk. Thanks so much. I feel so honored that you asked me to be on
of course.
The podcast.
Thanks. All right. Well, we will talk to you soon, hopefully. It's so good to chat with you.
Good to chat with you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Good Dirt Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll share it with a friend to spread the good dirt.
This show is produced by Lady Farmer, a slow living lifestyle community, and the original music is composed and performed by John Kingsley.
For more from Lady Farmer, follow us on Instagram at @WeAreLadyFarmer. That's @WeAreLadyFarmer. Or join us online at www.ladyfarmer.com. We'll see you next time on The Good Dirt.
Goodbye.